All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is September 20th, and we're going to do appendicular skeleton today. A little bit, we did axial skeleton last time. I want to remind everybody that this week practicums start on Wednesday. All right, so if you have a Monday lab, you have another week to catch up to everybody. And it looks like SI has got a mock practicum schedule. I see a box of bones right there, both today and on Wednesday. Well, it looks like today is done because it started at 8. Did anybody go to the 8 o'clock today? Was it a mock practicum? Indeed it was. Okay, so I guess there's going to be another review on Wednesday at 8 o'clock. So that's really handy. Don't forget there are really good drag and drop exercises in Blackboard to help you with the practicum. There's some videos because we're covering the integument on the practicum this time. We didn't do it last time. So there's some really good videos in Blackboard. And also, in the display cases, I'm putting more and more specimens in the display cases outside the anatomy lab. So you can go up there and see if you can answer what those lead lines are pointing to. There's no key, so take your book with you so that you can figure out the answers to the questions. Okay. And if you got a question, I suppose you could ask me, but I'll have to be in person because I haven't memorized all those numbers right there. All right, so on to appendicular skeleton. So don't forget, there's something else I wanted to do. So don't forget. Test. Volume. I want to use this little contraption here today. Volume. Ah, good. So even if you guys are talking up there in the back row, all right, I can talk louder than you. But you should probably not goof around so much because there might be somebody who really wants to pay attention to the lecture. All right, so this is a new little device right here. How's that sound? Can you hear me a little louder? Is that good? Even better? Ah, that's even better. Good. Okay. So I'll put this on the clip. Let's see if we get some feedback. So far, so good. Maybe it's a little loud. All right, so don't forget, if we're going to take all the bones of the skeleton, we can break them down into two main categories. What are the two main categories? Axial and appendicular skeleton. Axial skeleton starts with the, on the top, skull bones. Skull bones. That lab at 7:30 is tough on Monday morning. I'm still not awake. Okay, so we got skull bones, and what else makes the axial skeleton? Vertebral column, and then sternum, and then the rib cage. Those all make the axial skeleton. And then appendicular skeleton are bones of the upper appendage and lower appendage. You don't really want to say arm and leg because we'll talk about what those definitions are in a little bit, plus the bones that attach the appendicular skeleton to the axial skeleton. The bones that attach the appendages to the axial skeleton have a special name because they surround your body. They surround your body in the superior thoracic cavity and then around the pelvic cavity. What do we call these bones that help attach the appendages to your axial skeleton? Those of you who have had lab should know. Those that haven't had lab yet on axial skeleton probably doesn't ring a bell. But those are the girdles. The girdles surround, a girdle is just something that surrounds something. So the bones that attach the upper appendage to the axial skeleton is the pelvic girdle. The bones that attach your lower appendage is the pelvic girdle. Okay, so what we have on the screen here on the right are the two bones that make up the pectoral girdle, and they are the clavicle, which is anterior, and the scapula, which is posterior. And the only joint that attaches your whole upper arm, would you guess that the joint that attaches your upper arm to the rest of your body, is that a big, powerful joint or kind of a dinky joint? You know what? It's actually quite small. Here it is right here. Right, it's just between the clavicle and the manubrium. That's the only joint that attaches your whole upper appendage to your axial skeleton. But surrounding your shoulder, attached to the clavicle and the scapula, are numerous muscles, which we're going to start looking at maybe at the end of next week. Right, so even though it's just one little joint, things that really stabilize joints are not the joint themselves, but the muscles that surround that particular joint. So that's a theme that we'll look at. All right, so nonetheless, we got the scapula in the front. It's got two ends. It looks kind of like an S. And both ends look flared, but one end is really flat. It kind of looks like a knife blade. I can't show you with just a picture. That's why you got to come to lab and look at the bones. This is the scapular end, or the acromial end. It articulates with the acromion process on the scapula. And then the other one that's flared, but it's flared in all three dimensions. It kind of looks like the opening of a trumpet or a clarinet or something. This is the manubrial end, or sternal end right here. It's much more massive than this end right here. So that's pretty much what you have to know for lab. Okay, the scapula is the other bone that makes the pectoral girdle. And here is the scapula. It's got this depression right here, which the head of the humerus fits into. And so typically, what do we call a depression that is holding something? A fossa. And as a matter of fact, you could call the glenoid cavity the glenoid fossa. As a matter of fact, I'm actually a little bit more particular to that term, but your book calls it the glenoid cavity. And of course, you would get credit for that if you put it on your test, because it's what? In your book. And we want to use your book as a good reference. So it can go by either name. All right, it's not a very deep fossa, which means that your shoulder has a lot of mobility. Your humerus can move with a lot of freedom within this glenoid cavity because it is not very deep. But there is a trade-off to that, right? Your shoulder has a lot of dexterity, but the trade-off is that the shoulder is not very strong. It can be damaged by various kinds of trauma, right? It can be disarticulated relatively easily compared to the hip joint, which we'll look at in a little bit. All right, so that is a nice depression. And generally speaking, what's the function of a depression or a fossa? It holds something, and it holds the head of the humerus right in here. Here is another fossa on the anterior side of the scapula, which is the side of the scapula that you normally can't see because it's up against your thoracic wall. This is holding a muscle in particular. And the name of this fossa is the subscapular fossa, which means that's the deepest part of the scapula as you go from superficial, where your skin is deep inside your body. And the muscle that it's holding is the subscapularis, right? So again, that just kind of underscores how much other anatomy you learn when you learn bones, right? You learn a lot of neuroanatomy, vascular anatomy, and muscle anatomy. So here is the subscapularis in this anterior side. All right, so that's two fossa that we've looked at so far. And now, what side of the scapula is this that has that glenoid cavity? Is it medial or lateral? It's lateral because that's what your arm is going to attach to, right? So here is the lateral border right here because that lines up with the glenoid fossa. And here is the medial border that lines up with all those spinous processes in your vertebral column. All right, so don't get fooled by that. Always keep a clear mind when you're thinking about these different borders and margins and whatever. And then here is the inferior part of the scapula, the inferior angle. Here's the superior angle, then the nice superior border. And before we get to these processes, here is the suprascapular notch. And supra just means what? On top of, the most superior part of the scapula. There's usually a very nice notch right here. All right, if we look at the other side, all right, so this is the part of the scapula that you can actually palpate, that you can feel, that you can look at with your naked eye. And usually when we look at somebody, we look at their anterior surfaces, right? Their face, their eyes, nose, things like that. All right, but in somebody's posterior, of course, we're looking at what? The posterior aspect of all those bones. So this is the part of the bone that you're most familiar with, that you're used to looking at. And this is the posterior side. The anterior side you don't see because that's deep inside your body. All right, so here's the posterior side of the scapula. Here is the spine. This is a big, massive ridge, and there are numerous muscles that attach to this, and those muscles are contained by two other fossa that we see. The supraspinous fossa, which is above the spine, and the infraspinous fossa, which is below the spine. And now you probably know the names of these muscles that are in these fossa. Okay, so for instance, this would be the supraspinatus occupying this space, and this would be the infraspinatus occupying this space right here. You probably couldn't tell me exactly the names, but you could have had a good guess, or at least matched them up pretty well. All right, so the spine moves from medial out to laterally, and right at the lateral edge of the spine of the scapula, there's a big, massive process for attaching ligaments and muscles, and this is the acromion process, and that's what you feel on the top of your shoulder. Okay, that's the acromion process. And then deep to that, there's a narrower one, that's the coracoid process, and there are muscles and ligaments that attach to that coracoid process right there. All right, so how many fossa did we look at on the scapula so far? Okay. I'm going to show you another little aspect of it. The first one we talked about is what? The glenoid fossa right here. That's right, it's called a cavity, so maybe you forgot to count that one. But here is the glenoid fossa. That's one. Here is the supraspinous fossa above the spine. And what kind of view are we got right here? This is a nice lateral view. We're looking right at somebody's shoulder, looking toward the inside of their body. This is a nice lateral view, right, because here's a glenoid fossa right here. So here's the supraspinous fossa, here's the infraspinous fossa, and then on the opposite side of the bone, we've got the subscapular fossa. And the subscapular fossa is what part of the bone? Is it medial? Is it lateral? Is it anterior? Or is it posterior? I try to really screw you up because I want you to have a picture in your mind. That's the anterior side of the scapula, right? And then this is the posterior side over here. And it's really easy to palpate that scapular spine. All right. So if we put the clavicle and scapula together, what do we get? I'm going to come on over to the other slide, slide on the left. What do we get? We get the pectoral girdle, right? And then you got to know some parts of those bones. Okay, I'm not going to get to the pelvic girdle right now because I think I'd rather start talking about the upper appendage. All right, so what are some bones of the upper appendage and the sign-in sheet? Did I give it to you? Oh, good. Yeah, pass that sign-in sheet. So I'm going to go back over to the slide on the right. All right, so let's go over some parts of the body. You learn some regional terms, and I want to go over some parts of the appendages, not strictly by the region, but by that part of your body. So between your shoulder and your elbow, what do we call that? That's your arm. Okay, now here's the tricky part. Between your elbow and your wrist, you might say, well, that's your arm, but that's not really your arm in anatomy. That is your forearm, right? So you got your arm and your forearm. Your lower appendage, between your hip and your knee, some people might think that's your leg, but it's not. It is your thigh. And between your knee and your ankle, that's your leg. Right? So the leg matches up with the forearm, and thigh matches up with your arm and the upper appendage. All right, so how many bones do we have in your arm? That's a good trick question because you got to know what your arm is. What the heck is your arm? It's between your shoulder and your elbow. And how many bones do you have in there? Just one, and that is the humerus. So here is the humerus. And we have a nice anterior view of the humerus right here. The proximal epiphysis, there's a nice smooth condylar surface right here. What's the function of a condyle? It's smooth, so it's for rubbing up against another bone, so it is for an articulation, right? And so the head is a condyle. We don't really call it a condyle. We just call it the head of the humerus, but you'll see in lab it's nice and smooth. It's covered with articular cartilage. That inserts into the glenoid fossa that produces then the shoulder joint in terms of the skeletal system anyway. Now here are a couple raised areas and they're called tubercles. Here's the bigger one, here's the smaller one, the greater and lesser tubercle. When you palpate these with your fingertip, they're going to be really rough. All right, so it's not a condylar surface, these are processes. What's the function of a process? Muscle attachment, that's right. So there are going to be muscles attached to the humerus, right, that are going to rotate the humerus or move it in other ways that we're going to learn those definitions in just a little bit. And then there's a long depression between the tubercles. That's the intertubercular groove. Maybe a good idea for you to say it out loud because that will help you remember how to spell it on the practicum, right? Intertubercular groove. And there is a real strong and important tendon that runs right between these tubercles, right, from your brachium up to your scapula, and you're going to see that's one of the parts of the biceps brachii. The biceps runs right between these tubercles right here. Okay, so those are important things. Now here is a diaphysis. About mid-diaphysis, there is a tuberosity, and a tuberosity is a rough raised area on a bone, which is another name for a process, and the function of a process is muscle attachment, and now you know what muscle attaches right there, because that's the name of this process right here. It's the deltoid. The deltoid is on the top of your shoulder that helps elevate your humerus, right? So it attaches right there. That's all you have to know about the diaphysis. Now, this distal epiphysis is pretty complicated. You'll have to spend some time in lab or with your books to put all these little different pieces together. But first off, there are some smooth surfaces right here, which are condyles. And here is one, and here is the other. They have such a special kind of structure that we don't call them condyles. This one over here is what we call the capitulum. And then this one over, and the capitulum kind of looks like a ball or a marble. It's nice and spherical. This other one that kind of looks like a little bobbin or spool that you could wind thread up on, that's the trochlea. But nonetheless, they're smooth, so, and they're really condyles with special names. So what's the function of the capitulum and the trochlea? Articulation, right? So there are articulations with bones that you have in your forearm. And since you have these two articulating surfaces, that would probably give you a clue as to how many bones you have in your forearm. As a matter of fact, you do have two. Okay, and when we look at this humerus right here, we should probably be able to recognize what the medial side is and what the lateral side is. And what's a good way to figure that out? Maybe not by looking at the distal epiphysis, but you will be able to in a little bit by, if you're looking at the head, which way is the head going to be pointing? Laterally or medially? It's got to be medially because that's where your scapula is. So that's pretty easy to figure out. So this right here where the cursor is the medial side of the humerus, and that's where the trochlea is. The lateral side has the capitulum. And if we look at the bones of the forearm, I'm going to have to scoot up a couple pictures right here. If we look at the forearm, here are the two bones in the forearm. The lateral bone is the radius, and the medial bone is the ulna. Okay, and the capitulum was lateral, right? That's what articulates with the head of the radius, and the trochlea articulates with the ulna. Here is a notch in the proximal part of the ulna, and we call that the trochlear notch. The trochlear notch fits right in with what? The trochlea. It matches up, okay, very, very nicely. Okay, come on, cursor. Maybe I'll try working the cursor on my notebook right here. Maybe a little bit better. Okay, so if we look at an enlarged region of the humerus up over here on top, and then the two bones of the forearm down below, right, so here's a nice lateral margin of these bones. Here's the capitulum, and the head of the radius fits in here very, very nicely. And if we were going to look way on top of the humerus, if you're going to follow that arrow up way past through the ceiling, what part of the humerus would you run into to confirm that this is the medial part? What would you see up there? That would be the head of the humerus, right, sticking medially into the glenoid fossa, but then coming down to the distal part, here's the trochlea, and you can see it inserting into the trochlear notch. The trochlear notch is made up by a couple processes. There's a coronoid process on the anterior side of the ulna, and on the posterior side of the ulna, right, so it flipped perspective because now lateral is on the right and medial is on the left over here. Here is the olecranon process. Right, so if we put the olecranon process and coronoid process together, it forms kind of like a hook that fits right over the trochlea, and they lock together really nice. So in lab, you got to pay really nice close attention to that. And of course, if you look at somebody's bony elbow right here at this point, you should relate that to this figure right here. All right, although it's not in three dimensions, that point of your elbow is really the point of the, where's my cursor at? Is the olecranon process on the ulna. Okay, so here's my cursor over there. So if I bring it over, come on over here. Okay, here is the point of your elbow. Sorry about that, cursor. Okay, that's the olecranon process. So that's the thing that you bang all the time. Okay, and that hurts, but that doesn't hurt as bad as sometimes you pinch a nerve that runs right through here when you bang this olecranon process. Now, that's really your funny bone when you depolarize that nerve and you get referred pain all over your arm. And that nerve runs right down the ulna. So now you could guess what the name of that nerve is. That's the ulnar nerve right there. Okay, so you'll see that when we get to the nervous system. Okay, now here's a depression, a fossa. This is on the posterior side. So if you look at my arm, the posterior side is up over here, right? And when I move my arm straight out, this olecranon process has to fit into a depression in the posterior side of the humerus, and we call that the olecranon fossa that accepts this olecranon process when your arm is straight. We call that extended. All right, when you flex your arm, okay, remember there was a, I think it's this way, nope. Here is that coronoid process that's sticking out anteriorly. When you flex your arm, there's got to be a corresponding fossa in the anterior side of the humerus for this coronoid process to fit in. So if we look back at the right here, right, so here's that coronoid process on the ulna. When you flex, this process fits into the coronoid fossa on the anterior side of the humerus. And then the head of the radius when your forearm is flexed fits into this radial fossa right here. Maybe you don't have to know that. I don't know if it's on your lab list or not. Okay, but you got the radial and coronoid fossa on the anterior side of the humerus. Okay, so for the test and for the practicum, for sure, you've got to know that this condylar surface right here that we call the capitulum articulates with what bone in your forearm? It's got to be the radius, right? And when you put them together in lab, you'll see how nicely they match up to each other. And then, of course, you also have to know that the trochlea matches up with the? Yeah, with the ulna. And in particular, you're going to see that nice trochlear notch in the ulna. Okay. Here is a tuberosity, which is a process. Guess what the function of that process is right there? Muscle attachment, and in particular, the biceps brachii. One part of it will attach right here, so that will raise your forearm up. Okay, that's what we call flexion. All right, so this is a pretty interesting joint, and in lab, you just got to put these things together, right, for them to make sense. Okay, but remember, this olecranon process is posterior, and it fits into the posterior fossa right here that we call the olecranon fossa at the distal epiphysis of the humerus. All right, so that's pretty much it for the arm and the forearm. Okay, almost the end. Here is a little sharp point at the head of the ulna. Now notice that the head of the ulna is distal, the head of the radius is proximal, right? They kind of change places. This is what we call the styloid process. And there's another styloid process over here on the radius that helps stabilize your wrist joint. And now we're pretty much done, except you should know that there's this interosseous membrane between the radius and ulna that helps stabilize that joint. Okay, so we're done with the arm. What bone is in the arm right here? That's the humerus. Okay, and then in the forearm you've got two bones. The lateral one is the radius. Now, for me, that's easy to remember, and maybe for some of you, it's easy to remember too. Okay, and that is sometimes we like to take somebody's pulse to see if they're alive, or at least to count their heart rate when their heart is beating. And there's an artery. Where would you palpate for that artery? Above your thumb or above your little finger? Above your thumb. And people always say that's the radial pulse. Now, why is that the radial pulse? Because that bone that's lateral is the radius, and the name of that blood vessel that runs down the radius is the radial artery. So that makes perfect sense that we call that the radial pulse, right? Because that's the name of that artery right there. So it's going to be right in this location. All right, so we're done with the arm and forearm. That takes us to, oh, look at that nice trochlear notch. I forgot I had this picture. Look at that nice trochlear notch. It's made up of the coronoid process and the olecranon process right there. And that trochlear notch fits right into what? The trochlea of the humerus. Okay, maybe we can see the styloid process once again on the radius and the ulna. Okay, so that takes us to bones of the wrist. And we've got two rows of bones. There's a proximal row and a distal row. And all of these bones as a group, I want you to know, are called carpals. You don't have to know the name of these except for one, because clinically it's the most relevant, because it gets crushed when people trip and fall and they catch themselves with their hands as they fall backwards or forwards or something. And it has a long, narrow piece right in this region right here, and that's called a scaphoid. And it butts right up against this big, massive part of the radius, right? Because how do you know this is the radius right here? Because here is here's the thumb, or the number one digit, right? That's your great finger right here. And when people fall, all the weight of your body comes right down this radius, and it bumps into this little tiny bone right here, and it kind of gets pulverized. And unfortunately, there's a tendency for that blood vessel to go into this bone to become damaged, and it never heals again. And of course, since this is living tissue, what happens to the scaphoid if its blood supply is interrupted and it never grows back? Well, it dies, right, and it dissolves away, and then you have kind of like this little hole right here in your wrist, and your wrist never really works quite the same again. All right, so the scaphoid is kind of an important bone to know, because it can be damaged very easily. All right, so that's one of the, so this group of bones right here we call carpals. They're in your wrist. Okay, then that takes us to the hand. Here are some long bones that make up the hand proper. All right, so here we got forearm, then we got wrist, and then here's your hand. And there are five long bones. They don't have names, they just have numbers. And you start counting with your thumb. So here's the number one. Now, we don't want to call those carpals. Those are metacarpals, right? Number one, metacarpal, two, three, four, five, metacarpal. Number five lines up with your little finger right here. Now, finger is not a really good anatomical term, okay? So these are bones of the hand, and these are fingers, but the proper term for these fingers are digits, okay? So these are all digits. And the bones in your digits, we don't call digits, they have special names too. They are phalanges. So all of these bones right here are phalanges. If we just look at one, then that is a phalanx. Phalanx is singular for phalanges. And you can see that you have a number of them. Some digits have three, like one, two, three. Other digits have one, two. Okay, that you have to know, especially for the practicum. All right, so in digit number one, or your thumb right here, there are only two. There's a proximal and distal phalanx. And so if you were going to name this bone, maybe there's a broken bone in somebody's hand, and you've got to be able to speak exactly about that particular location. So if this bone is broken, how would you tell somebody that this bone is broken and not any of these other bones? You would say, number one, proximal phalanx, right? And then you probably have to say a right or left hand, but you're probably good with that. Raise your left hand. Okay, pretty good. That's good. Practice that. Okay, so this is the number one, right, proximal phalanx, which means in your thumb. And if you look at your thumb, you can see, right, this joint right here is between the metacarpal and the proximal phalanx, and then you have one more joint right there, and that's just between the proximal and distal phalanx of the thumb. Unlike digit number two, and then of course three, four, and five, we have three bones, right? So here is the proximal number two phalanx, here's the middle number two, and then here is the distal number two phalanx. All right, so make sure you could name, for instance, this phalanx right here. How would you name that one?
Four.
Number four, middle phalanx, right? And that's in the number four digit, right? So make sure you get that nomenclature down. It seems really easy, but for some reason, students confuse it during a practicum. I don't know why that is. Maybe you're rushing or something. I'm not sure. But just remember, you start counting with what? Your thumb, okay, all the way down. All right, so that's pretty good for the upper appendage, the bones and some important processes. The only thing that I didn't really mention is that there is a nice joint, not just between the bones of the forearm and the carpals and between the forearm and the arm, But there are joints between the ulna and radius as well. They fit into each other. Because if you're in anatomic position, the palms of your hands are facing anteriorly. Well, what else can you do with your hands? You can have your palms face posteriorly. We call that pronation. When they're facing anterior, that's supinated. All right, so when you pronate your hands, when the palms face posteriorly, the ulna and radius actually cross over each other. They actually pivot around each other and cross over. And so there are special articulations between the head of the ulna. That's why the head of the ulna is nice and round. It fits into a little notch in the radius. All right, and since this is the radius right here, and here is the notch in the radius, what would you want to call that notch? Remember when we named, when we named a part of the temporal bone as it's coursing forward and touching the zygomatic bone, what did we call that process on the temporal bone that's touching the zygomatic bone? That's the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. So sometimes we name things after not the bone that they exist on, but the bone that attaches at that location, right? So right here is the ulnar notch on the radius. All right, so let's go back a couple. Oh, I'm sorry, we have to go back quite a few. All right, so here is the radius. Remember, the distal end is the big massive part of it. Here is the head of the ulna, which is the small round part. And then here is that ulnar notch so that you can pronate and supinate so that these two bones can actually rotate and cross over each other very nicely right here. All right, so here's the ulnar notch and the radius. Now, what did the head of the radius look like? It looked nice and round as well, so that it can rotate within the ulna. So let's go see if we can find that part of the ulna. Oh, yeah. So here is the radius, and then here's the ulna over here. And in the medial side, you're going to notice a nice, smooth little facet of depression right here that accepts the head of the radius, right? So do you believe this is the ulna right here? How would you know this is the ulna? Really easy to tell because here's that coronoid process, olecranon process, and this big, huge trochlear notch, right? And then just distal to this trochlear notch, you've got another notch that accepts the head of the radius, right? So this is in the ulna, so we call this the radial notch. And then maybe just to quiz your mind, what side of the ulna is this radial notch in? Where is the radius compared to the ulna? It's got to be lateral, so that notch has got to be on the lateral side of the ulna. Okay, so that's sort of how you piece things together in terms of anatomy. Now this surface right here, this trochlear notch, what should that surface be like? Should it be smooth or rough? Well, why smooth? Why is that smooth? Why is that smooth? And where is it? What joint is this making up? It's making your elbow. Fantastic. So I kind of gave you a clue. It's smooth because it makes up a joint. Okay? So it makes up a joint with the humerus. And what part of the humerus does it match up with? The trochlea. Yeah, it matches up with the trochlea. The trochlear notch matches up with the trochlea. The radial notch, what does it match up with? The radius, and the ulnar notch down over here matches up with the ulna, but it's on the radius. Okay, did you see the nice parallel there? Should I say it again? What does the trochlear notch match up with? The trochlea. What does the radial notch match up with? Radius. And the ulnar notch matches up with the ulna. Okay, but now you just got to remember what bone each of those little pieces are on. Okay. All right, so that's the elbow. That's a pretty fancy joint because not only is it a hinge joint, not only can you flex and extend, but you can also pronate and supinate with that joint, okay, because of these ulnar and radial notches. All right, so that takes us to the lower appendage. What attaches the lower appendage to your axial skeleton? Yeah, the pelvic girdle, okay? The pelvic girdle is made out of two os-coxae bones. But let's review. What about pectoral girdle? What's a pectoral girdle made out of? The clavicle and scapula that completely surround your superior thoracic cavity. All right, the bones that completely surround your pelvic cavity, okay, are the two Ascoxae bones. So I see one here and one here, and then put together with the sacrum. But remember, sacrum, is that part of the axial skeleton or appendicular skeleton? That's really officially part of your axial skeleton, right? It's part of the vertebral column. But we just include it in this diagram right here because it fits so nice with the hip bones. All right, so here is one hip bone. Here is the other one. A hip bone is also called an ascoxae or a coxal bone. All right, kind of a funny spelling, ascoxae. And the ascoxae is actually made up of three different bones that have fused together, and sometimes we can't even separate them when we look in lab. There's usually only one place where we can see all three bones coming together. The superior one that we definitely notice as a hip bone, this is the ilium. The superior bone is the ilium. The anterior bone right here is the pubis. And then the posterior and inferior bone right here is the ischium. So these three bones come together to form the ascoxae. And here is on the medial side of the ilium, here's the iliac fossa. What's the job of a fossa? Holding something. A lot of internal organs fit into this area right here. Okay, here's the joint between the two pubic bones. We call that the pubic symphysis. And in lab, we do want you to know how to tell the difference between a male and female pelvis. So if we look at this right here, sometimes we call this a pelvis. If we take the two ascoxae, put it together with a sacrum, we call that a pelvis. This angle right here that's formed by these inferior rami. Ooh, what's a rami? If you have a major body of a bone, like here's the body of the pubis, and then there's a 90 degree angle right here coming off the body, that's a ramus. Like the ramus of the mandible is that one that's sticking up at a 90 degree angle from the body of the mandible. Here's the superior ramus of the pubis. But if we look at this inferior pubis, ramus of the pubis, it forms the pubic arch right here. And in females, this pubic arch is going to be greater than 90 degrees. And in the male, it will be about 90 or maybe a little bit less. And of course, that's just a nice modification for parturition or giving birth that enlarges the birth canal when this pubic arch is enlarged. I don't know if I have an example of a male pelvis anywhere. Sorry, I don't think I do. No, I sure don't. But in lab, you'll be able to tell the difference from across the room. Okay. Also, this little part right here is called the ischial spine. If you look laterally in the female, there'll be plenty of room between the coccyx and this ischial spine, but in the male, they almost superimpose on each other. There's no room. So those are some nice dead giveaways as to the male and female. Okay, what was the fossa in the scapula that articulates with the head of the humerus? What was that called? Okay, start with a G. Glenoid cavity, but you could call it glenoid fossa. I would kind of like that probably. Here is another fossa, okay, because you can call things by different names. Here is another fossa right here, but it's so special we call it the acetabulum. Okay, and again, the acetabulum is going to be what, medial or lateral on an ascoxae? It's going to be lateral, just like the glenoid fossa on the scapula. And it's a depression that's going to hold or accept the head of the femur, just like the glenoid fossa accepts the head of the humerus. Now, this one, if we look, we're going to see is very deep. It's very pronounced. That has some implications. Namely, since it's a lot deeper, you don't have the same range of motion with your lower appendage that you do with your upper appendage, right? Not nearly the same mobility because the socket is very deep. But the trade-off is, if the shoulder is relatively weak because the glenoid fossa is shallow, the hip is relatively what? Because the acetabulum is very deep. It's very strong, right? It's a powerful joint, can withstand a lot of trauma and a lot of weight. And indeed, that's really good because we walk with our legs, not our arms, right? Okay, so it has to be a stronger joint. Now, on this picture, you can see the three bones. Once again, here's the ilium, that's superior. Here's the pubic bone, which is anterior. And then here's the ischium, that is more posterior and inferior, that make up the ascoxae. So it's crucial for you to pick up an ascoxae in lab, turn it around upside down and backwards and model it on your body so that you can see exactly which side is which is something that you can't do with this particular picture right here. Okay, but if we go back one slide, the anterior bone is the pubic bone that we see right here. So let's find the pubic bone. Here's that pubic bone right in the front. So this is what side of the ascoxae? This is the anterior, and over here is going to be the posterior side, right? So become really familiar with the three-dimensional object in lab. Okay, there are a number of important processes on the ilium, namely the iliac crest is very important. It's a muscle attachment. As a matter of fact, this whole ala, this whole fan-shaped part of the ilium, has big, strong muscles that go into your leg, right, or your thigh to help you walk around so that you can stand erect. There are other processes right here on the anterior side. These are iliac spines for muscle attachment. Powerful leg muscles attach here and here. All right, so here's anterior. This is all anterior, and it's all on the ilium. So here's the anterior superior iliac spine, and then here's the anterior one that's below the anterior. So that is what the inferior iliac spine. Right, that matches up with the pubis. So back over here, these processes are going to be what? Posterior. Another good landmark for the posterior side of the ascoxae is this big notch right here. And we call that the greater sciatic notch. That's going to be on the posterior side of the ilium. So here's the posterior superior and the posterior inferior iliac spine. Those are all part of the ilium. And here you can see the lines of fusion right inside the acetabulum. If we look at a real ascoxae, we should be able to see these lines of fusion between the three bones. Okay, so here's the ilium. What's the bone that's posterior and inferior to the ilium? That is the ischium. So here's the ischium. Okay, and here is another spine. Now, is this spine on the ischium or the ilium? It's on the ischium, all right? So don't confuse it with these two over here. It is definitely posterior, so you might have a tendency to call that like the posterior inferior iliac spine, but could that be the iliac spine or any of the iliac spines? No, because it's not on the ilium. It's on the ischium, right? So therefore, we call that the ischial spine because that's the bone that it's on, all right? And that separates the greater sciatic notch from this lesser sciatic notch right here. Right? So that's how you kind of work around the bone a little bit. Here is a big, massive, bony prominence that, can you see, it's very, very rough. That is a process. It's such an important process. Right? We call it a tuberosity because it's so big. That is the, would you call that the ilium tuberosity? Would you call it the pubic tuberosity? No, because it is on the ischium, right? So that's the ischial tuberosity. That's what you guys are sitting on right now, okay? And then here's a big hole in the ascoxae. We call that the obturator foramen. There's a blood vessel that goes through there. Take a guess what the name of that blood vessel is. Obturator artery. Okay, so again, that really kind of underscores. All right, now here is looking at the medial side, which is the interior of the ascoxae. All right, so here's the pubic bone. Is that anterior or posterior? The pubic bone is anterior, right? So here are the anterior spines on the ilium. Here are the posterior spines because that's on the opposite side of the pubic bone, but here's that greater sciatic notch, which is posterior. Here is a surface for articulating with the sacrum, so that's the auricular surface. And what else do I want to say about this? In lab, try to find this arcuate line right here. That's very easy to see. That kind of separates the true pelvis, which is below. There's a cavity right below the arcuate line with the false pelvis, which goes between the arcuate line and this iliac crest right here. Okay, so that's pretty good for an ascoxae. And if we put a couple ascoxae together, what does it form? What does it help attach? Yeah, it forms a girdle, right? That attaches your lower appendage to your axial skeleton via this joint right here. Okay, the sacroiliac joint. Okay, so now we're ready to talk about the bone that articulates with the acetabulum, and of course that is the femur. So here's a femur, that's the largest bone in your body, it's a nice long bone. Here is the head of the femur, and it's going to articulate with the acetabulum. So what is this surface going to be like? Could you characterize that surface for me? Nice and smooth if it's a healthy femur. All right, receives blood supply from a blood vessel that comes right in here to the fovea capitis. There's also a big, strong ligament, and a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. That ligament attaches to the acetabulum, which further stabilizes the joint. And when people receive trauma to the hip, like lateral trauma or whatever, it can damage that ligament and damage that blood vessel going into the head of the femur. And just like the scaphoid, when its blood supply gets damaged, what happens to the head of the femur when that blood vessel gets damaged? It dies. Because remember, bone is a living organ, right? Every 5 years, you'll have new bones in your body all over the place. And then when the head of that femur dissolves away, you really don't have a hip joint anymore, and you need a replacement hip, a prosthetic put in there. Okay? And you might say, well, you probably wouldn't elect to do that, but that happens to quite a few people. And I think of one professional athlete who was so good he could play baseball and football in the same season. Okay? And he had to end up getting an artificial hip because this hip was damaged so much when he was being tackled, okay, that he got a prosthetic hip, but he was such a fantastic athlete, he could even still play professional baseball, which is just unbelievable, with an artificial joint in the hip. Anybody know who that is? I mentioned it in lab. That was Bo Jackson, okay? Amazing athlete. And that's because that blood vessel got damaged going right in here. All right, so here is the head, and then this little narrowing right here is what we call the neck of the femur. And just like the humerus has the tubercles, the femur has these massive processes right here, but they're even a lot bigger than tubercles, so we call these trochanters. Trochanters are on the femur. Greater trochanter, lesser trochanter. And then we just have the nice diaphysis. And there was a process on the humerus about mid-diaphysis. What was that process on the humerus? Can you remember? And it was named after a muscle that attaches right there. The deltoid tuberosity, okay, deltoid tuberosity. On the femur, there is a process, but it's long and narrow. It's not named after the muscle. There are a number of muscles that attach, and you should just know that this is called the linea aspera. Right, because it's just a long linear process. It's not raised very much, but it's long and narrow, but nonetheless it's really rough. So when you get to lab, you can palpate it. You don't have to know anything about these gluteal tuberosities, right, or these condylar lines right here, but I think the linea aspera you do have to know something about. All right, when we get down to the distal part of the femur, we see some nice smooth surfaces here and here. And that, what's the function of these smooth surfaces? And what's the name of a typical smooth surface? The function is for articulation, and the name would be a condyle, like mandibular condyle for the temporomandibular joint. Here is a condyle, right? But we don't call that a condyle because it's so special. It's nice and round, spherical. We call that the head of the femur. But down over here, these are condyles. There's a medial and lateral one. And they're going to articulate with the bone in your leg, mostly the tibia, okay? Now, you do have to know which one is medial and lateral, and how the heck are you going to figure that out? You just look at the head, and which way is the head going to be, medial or lateral? It's got to be medial, right? So here's the medial condyle, here's a lateral condyle over here, and here's a nice big notch between them, that's the medial, that's the intercondylar fossa. This is on the posterior side of the femur. On the anterior side, there is a bone in your knee joint that you don't have in your upper appendage. And you should probably know the name of that bone. Maybe you knew the name of that bone before you took an anatomy class. Okay, and that's your kneecap, which is called the patella. And the patella fits right in this spot. So here's a nice, smooth articulating surface, and we call that the patellar surface. That is going to slide very nicely up against the patella. When we get to joints, the one joint I'm going to have you know a lot about is the knee. We're not going to spend a lot of time with other joints, but the knee is going to be your favorite joint in the next chapter. Okay. Then up above the condyles, we have epicondyles, and they're large, rough areas on the femur right here. So they're really processes. So what are the function of these two epicondyles? Muscle attachments, right? So there's going to be muscles that attach that actually go across the knee. So here is the lateral epicondyle. Would you agree this is the lateral? And how would you know? Because it's on the other side compared to the head of the femur. And here is the medial epicondyle right here. Okay, so you got the patella. Where's the patella? Sorry. I'll show you a patella sooner or later. Okay. Well, if you have two bones in the forearm, you could probably guess how many bones you have in your leg. You've got two as well. Okay, but don't forget that kneecap. And in the forearm, you got a medial and lateral. What's the lateral one in your forearm? That's the radius. The medial one is the ulna. That's relatively easy to remember. Now, the two in your leg are relatively difficult to remember which one is medial and which one is lateral, typically for students. All right. The medial one is this big, huge one, almost as big as the femur. That is the tibia right here. You don't have a lot of muscles surrounding the tibia, and this anterior border or anterior crest kind of sticks out. So whenever you bang your leg, this bone gets bashed, okay, and contuses this bone. Sometimes we call that the shin bone right there, and it can bruise up pretty easily. So if you palpate your leg medially, you'll actually feel like during a test or the practicum, you can actually palpate that tibia because there's no muscle around it. And that's the medial one. The lateral one is completely surrounded by muscle, big strong muscles, and you can't feel it at all. And that is the fibula. Right? So tibia, brute force, you just have to remember that's the medial bone and the lateral bone is the fibula. If somebody can tell me a good trick to remember that, I would pass it on, but I don't have a good trick. Okay, so that's a nice way for you to remember. Anything that works, maybe if you want to write a poem, a song, okay, a little saying, anything that can help you remember that the tibia is medial. Ah, medial. Tibia is medial, fibula is lateral. Well, guess what? Both have L's in them. I was going to say, well, there's an L in lateral. No, they both have L's. So nothing really is easy. You just got to remember that. Okay. And the reason why that is important is because there are some condylar surfaces on this proximal end of the tibia that articulate with the condyles of the femur. Okay, and so here is the medial condyle of the tibia. Here's the lateral condylar surface on the tibia. And here we see a nice crest between them, this little raised prominent area right here between the condyles. That's the intercondylar eminence. Some big strong ligaments attach between this eminence right here and that intercondylar notch in the fibia, and they kind of cross over each other like that. And a name for things that cross over in anatomy, we like to say they're cruciate something, right? And since they're ligaments in the knee, guess what they're called? The name of those ligaments that cross over? The cruciate ligaments. There's one that's in the front that would be called the anterior cruciate ligament. There's one that's in the back that would be the posterior cruciate ligament when we start to look at the knee. All right, so you got to know which one is medial and lateral in terms of these condylar surfaces. Here is a process for attaching big, strong, powerful muscles in your anterior thigh. Insert right here into the tibia. This is the tibial tuberosity. That allows you to extend your leg like when you're kicking something. All right, and then we got the diaphyses right here, and then your ankle joint. Right, your ankle bones that really poke out on either side. Right, here's the we call that a malleolus. Here's the medial malleolus on the tibia, and here is the lateral malleolus on the fibula. Right, so there's not like a, I used to think there was a pin going across right there that your foot would kind of rotate around like the dens on, what bone has the dens? Yeah, C2, or axis, right? I thought it formed like a little axis right there that your foot would rotate around, but that's not true at all. It just forms a little notch. The lateral malleolus and the medial malleolus form this little notch right here that a bone fits in, and a bone in your ankle fits right in this area right here, okay? All right, and we've talked about some bones already of your wrist, which we call carpals. The bones of your ankle aren't called carpals. They're called tarsals. Okay, I don't think I need to talk about any of the posterior parts of the tibia. All right, so that takes us to the foot. Make sure in lab you can tell the difference between a foot and a hand. And what's the big adaptation of the foot compared to the hand? Bones of the foot are bigger and more massive because they got to hold up more weight, right? So in the wrist, you've got carpals. In the foot, we don't have carpals. We have tarsals instead. And I want you to know the names of two tarsals. The one that fits between the tibia and fibula, right, in that little notch right here, is the talus. So here's the dome of the talus. It fits right in there. And that's what allows you to lift your toes up and off the ground really nice. And then this other big bone right here is called the calcaneus. That forms your heel. So that's the one you step on all the time. And there's a big, strong muscle that attaches to the calcaneus via a tendon called the Achilles tendon. And that muscle is in the back of your foot. So when that muscle contracts, it pulls the calcaneus superior. When your calcaneus is pulled superior, what happens to your toes? Because it rotates right around this region right here. So if the calcaneus moves superior, your toes move inferior, your toes point into the ground. All right, so we'll look at that when we start talking about muscles. So the gastrocnemius pulls on the calcaneal tendon or Achilles tendon on this calcaneus, and it kind of pushes your toes with a lot of force into the ground. All right, so calcaneus and talus. And then the bones of your foot proper are metatarsals, just like you have metatarsals in your hand, and they're named starting with the great toe, so that's number one. Here's the fifth metatarsal. And the phalanges have exactly the same kind of structure as your hand. Okay, so here are all the phalanges up over here. Here's number one proximal, number one distal, and then number two proximal, number two, okay, I'm trying to trick you, number two what? Middle, and then number two distal. Right, so only digit number one has two. All the rest have three phalanges, the proximal, middle, and distal. And it seems really easy to remember that, but a lot of students mess up on that one for some reason. I'm not really sure why that is. Okay, so practice. Maybe it seems so easy, but you still have to practice that. Okay, so what did I forget? Okay, there are arches in the foot, okay, that help distribute weight. There are normal arches in the foot. Where's the cursor? Okay, that help distribute weight. Okay, so there's this transverse arch that goes from medial to lateral, right? There's a lateral longitudinal arch along your little toe back to the calcaneus, and then there's this medial longitudinal arch. And these things flatten and stretch as weight is distributed over your foot as you walk. So those are important arches. And I believe that's it for the appendicular skeleton. Okay, so what are the tricky parts of the appendicular skeleton? The elbow, knowing the capitulum and the trochlea. So what bone is the capitulum and trochlea located on? The humerus, right? Which one is going to be lateral, the capitulum or trochlea? The capitulum, and remember the capitulum looks like a ball. The trochlea looks like a bobbin or a spool or something. So what articulates with the capitulum, the ball? The head of the radius, right, is nice and round. It has a nice fossa in the head of the radius so that it matches up with the capitulum. Now, what about the trochlea? What matches up with the trochlea or articulates with the trochlea? The ulna, and in particular, what part of the ulna? the trochlear notch. The trochlear notch is made out of the hook, which is the proximal part is the olecranon process, and the inferior part is the coronoid process. Fits right over the trochlea. All right, so those are kind of the hard things. I think the rest, if you just pay attention to and look at a couple of times, will make pretty good sense. All right, so don't forget about the sign-in sheet. Now, do we have a test next time? No, we do not. We have another lecture. We have another lecture on joints. So if you want to read ahead a little bit and look at some joints, when the heck is our next test? Not until October. Wow, October 4th. Oh, I know why that is. It's a little delayed, but that's because I didn't want to have a practicum and a lecture test on the same day. So next week on Monday, some people are getting a practicum, so I couldn't have a test on that day. So you can't forget any of your bones. We only have one more lecture, and then that's going to end the material for the next test. Okay. Okay, thanks. That's it for lecture today. What about the microphone? Is that decent? I think that helps.